Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. How are you? Look, I know it's Thanksgiving. I know. Some of you might be at home. You might be back home where you come from, back with your family, holed up in your old room. We do this every year, and it's always a little difficult for some people, but I think for some people it's going to be a lot more difficult if they even made the trip because, well, we had a major election a few years back, but this is another big one. It's very divided, and it's going to be hard for some families to survive it. I mean, obviously not, you know, living, but God forbid, you know, things could get that ugly. But I mean, to survive the emotional bonds of family. No matter how troubled they may be without this stuff, if there's political divisiveness within the family, whew, man, it's going to be rough out there for some people. I know it. I'll speak to it as best I can. I'm not going back. I couldn't go back down. I couldn't go to Florida because of work, but there's a couple of people within the unit, within the extended family that comes to Thanksgiving that I've always been at odds with. And now it's, there's two sides to this thing. There's actually more. It's a lot more nuanced than that. But when it comes right down to it, one side won, the other side didn't. There's a lot of vulnerable, sensitive, thoughtful, progressive people out there that are now just in shock and stunned and more vulnerable. Because now they have to deal with the aggressive gloating of the other side. And that's hard. It's horrible. If I can speak to the 9 conservatives who listen to my show, if you have people in your family who are wounded by this situation and are looking down the barrel at 4 years of the best it can be is horrible. And that's not even being cynical for people who believe a certain way. Could I just say to you few conservatives who listen to this, who have members of your family that you're going to be seeing today, ease up on the aggressive gloating, the condescension, the infantilizing. Just ease up. All right. Help out here in this particular situation. Before I get into this too much, and I don't even know how much to get into it, but to speak from where I'm sitting and just to project the possible horrors in terms of arguments and crying and yelling and discomfort that some homes are going to be feeling, you know, I can only speculate. But I would like to read, because sometimes, you know, I wonder, you know, what my place is. As a broadcaster and as somebody that a student of the human heart and spirit, you know, when the chips are down and things get shitty, I sometimes wonder, you know, what do I do here? I know what I do. I talk about myself. I talk to other people about things that interest me and about their life. But I get this email, and this is what keeps me going sometimes. It's from a guy named Robert. Just says, thank you. Hi, Mark. I love your podcast, but that's not why I'm emailing you. I wanted to email you to tell you thank you. Before I go into it, I want to say I'm not doing this to get attention or even to have you read this on the podcast or anything like that. I'm emailing you because you made a difference in my life. I listen to your podcast every week while I work and I hear about the people who email you to tell you thanks for various things, and I finally worked up the courage to email you. I was going through a rough time in my life when I was introduced to your podcast. I couldn't accept who I was as a person, and it felt like there was a giant hole that couldn't be filled inside. I lost who I was for a long time, and that culminated in a suicide attempt, which led me to being put in a mental hospital for a short time. When I got out, my girlfriend, who I am still with today, surprised me with your book, Attempting Normal, because she knew I was a fan of the podcast and your stand-up. I love the book so much. Your book, and especially the time you take on each episode to delve into your mind and your honesty about yourself and learning to live with who you are as a person, helped me feel okay with who I am. It helped me feel like I wasn't alone when I truly felt so isolated and alone that I didn't want to live anymore. I can't describe how much relief and hope I felt because someone else, someone who had a real voice, talked about many of the things I was feeling. Sometimes the things you said and the things I've read in your book are actual thoughts I've had. It made a world of difference. And I soon sought help after that, realizing that I couldn't do it alone, and I'm a much happier person now because of it. But most of all, you helped me feel like a real person. I truly think you are a special person, and as many people have said, you have a real way of humanizing and getting to the heart and soul of your guests. And something truly special and amazing happens every time you sit down in the garage for an interview. I was born in New Mexico, and I've never really been proud of my home state, but you make me proud to be a New Mexican. I hope this email finds you well. Hope all is well with the cats, and please keep up the great work. Much love, respect, and admiration being sent your way. Robert Boomer Lives. So I guess the thing that strikes me is that, you know, there's a lot of people feeling isolated, but, you know, and feeling alone or at odds or on the wrong end of the thing and whatever. But you're not. Okay, you're not. And I know going into Thanksgiving, you're going to get beat up, and you already were beat up. If you have people with different political views than you, you know who I'm talking to. Let me just get a little business done here. I'm going to be in Chicago on December 3rd, two shows at the Vic. You can go to WTFpod.com, tour/tour. I think the first show is kind of sold out. The second show, there's still seats. But it's looking good there, and I'd love to see. I'm excited to go to Chicago. I like going to Chicago. I like performing. Something's happened. I've always liked it. But now it's like, I got to do it. I got to show up for the people that are showing up for deeper reasons than just comedy. It's just the way I feel. Also, new WTF cap mugs are available tomorrow, Black Friday, from Brian Jones up in Portland. These are the same mugs I give to my guests. They go on sale at 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific tomorrow, November 25th. Go to brianrjones.com to get yours. People love these. These are good gifts as well. What else? Well, look, you know, a lot of families are going to be tested. The relationships are going to be tested. It's going to be difficult. Christ, before this election, even football could test relationships and families, and just seeing the people once or twice a year can test it. I mean, it is. It's difficult. And I know some people are entering family situations where they're like, why? Why did you vote the way you did? Why? Why would you vote for that guy? Or why? I thought, you know, I thought we had some basic understanding. This is going to be a real test of the love that holds families together. It is. The country is divided, so this is going to show up around the turkey. Like, let's say you have a father or a brother, and you're like, why the fuck would you vote the way you did? And just ask yourself, make a checklist for yourself. Are they needy? Are they volatile? Are they self-absorbed? Are they impulsive? Are they thin-skinned? Are they defensive? Are they manipulative? Are they scared of change? And instead of changing, would they make life miserable for other people to fight that change? Are they set in their ways? Are they horrendously terrified of and angry about the possibility of losing? Are they stubborn? Now, that's a profile. That could go either way. But if you have a hard time understanding why someone would vote the way they did, maybe look at that checklist and maybe ask yourself, were they always like that? Does it make sense? Even if you don't agree with it, even if it was a wrong decision, does it make sense for that person? Has that person always been like that? Maybe that'll give you a little wiggle room to hold on to some love for some people that you may hate right now. And in like mothers, sisters, where are do they are they the type of person that covers up and apologizes for the guy that I just described? All right, well, maybe. Maybe have they always been that way? Maybe that'll find you a little wiggle room for acceptance. I mean, a lot of us are just in the process of accepting the reality of what's happened. We've gone through a few stages, and this is like, you know, you're walking into something that's going to rip open the wound again. Yeah. The wound of losing and the wound of being terrified for the future. And believe me, the people in your family, if they aren't, you know, horrible, evil people, they don't know what's going to happen. No one knows what's going to happen. And they might be glib about it. And as I said before, aggressive gloating, condescension, infantilizing, i.e., all those add up in certain instances to just bullying. Hard to deal with. It's going to be rough go. But take some time. If you need to step away, step away. And I say this, you know, outside of politics. I've said it before on Thanksgiving. Step away. Take a walk. Go look at your old hangouts. Drive around. Remember what it was like to be a teenager when you had it all in front of you. Listen to some music. Try to hit a reset. Try to get through it. Try to love despite the anger, if you can. Scott Fagan is on the show. It's a very interesting story. Scott Fagan did a sort of masterful album in 1968 called South Atlantic Blues. And it's been dug up and remastered and reissued by St. Cecilia Knows and Light in the Attic Records. And it's a beautiful record, but it's an insane story that, you know, everything was moving in the right direction and shit just didn't go the way it was supposed to. And he was set to wandering after the record tanked. And then it was resurrected in a very odd way. It's an amazing story. From a very gifted artist with a very unique past. And he was reunited with his son who was who he didn't know, he never met, but years and years later, who is Stephen Merritt from Magnetic Fields. And it's so weird because I talked to Scott about it. Like Stephen knew his father, a musician, but he didn't know who he was. Until he met him much later in life. And Scott had mentioned, you'll hear it. He mentioned that when he heard the music that his son made, he could hear himself in it. And I listened to the Magnetic Fields sort of for the first time just the other night because Merge Records sent me their first two albums that they reissued. And I can hear it too. It was like genetic. It's fucking trippy, man. But so Scott's going to be on the show in a minute. And it was a pretty beautiful interview. Because like I'd read an article about this record and I met the guy that found the record and got behind it. And, you know, he told me about the guy and it just was a fascinating thing. I'm fascinated with people that put one thing out there that is beautiful and monumental and then disappear for whatever reason. And to have something kind of be reintroduced. Like I talked to Terry Reed, also a Light in the Attic artist. But like Light in the Attic is a very good label for this stuff. But this Scott Fagan thing was just... It was fascinating. It was fascinating to talk to him. And the album is beautiful. It really is. But that said, you can get the album South Atlantic Blues over at Light in the Attic Records. And this is me talking to the very wise and slightly beat up, but beautiful Scott Fagan.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Fagan. How many days you been in L.A.?
This time, two.
2 days?
Yeah.
How long you staying?
Until Thursday.
Do you like coming out here?
I lived here for a while. I've been
what years?
Through L.A. many, many times.
Right? Many lifetimes.
Yeah, yeah.
What were the years?
First came out in 1972 with my rock opera Soon.
Right.
We did it at the Pilgrimage.
Uh-huh.
I came up in 87.
Yeah.
And I came up to go to UCLA to learn program design. I designed a recovery program for the music business.
And did it take?
It did.
Really? What's
now
it called?
It's called Music Ears.
And what's the angle? How does it work?
Well, originally, you may know that, I'm guessing that it's true of comedians as well, but most musicians are independent contractors.
That's right.
No coverage for treatment.
Right.
The reality, or my reality, is that musicians have a tremendous impact on the society.
Yes.
If we're trying to support recovery for the society,
yeah.
Supporting recovery for musicians. I got sober in New York.
What year?
1978.
Oh, you're an old timer.
May 24.
You know.
1978.
That was the day.
Chock full of nuts.
Oh, right.
On the Upper West Side.
Having that, sitting there with that coffee at the counter.
Oh, yeah. No. Chock full of real nuts, not the coffee joint.
Okay.
Name of the group was Chelsea Riverside,
okay.
But it was better known as Chock full of nuts.
Got it.
And I was elected chairperson within the first year because they could see that I needed it more than most.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so then I went back to St. Thomas, which is where I'm from. The incidence of alcohol-related deaths in St. Thomas is impressive. In the States, Texas is the highest.
Yeah.
Alaska's double that.
Yeah.
And the Virgin Islands are double Alaska.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. So when I was a boy, there was no minimum drinking age. We just drank from the very beginning. And alcoholism is all over the place there.
But
so,
you weren't born there.
We went when I was five in 1951.
So when you were, we'll come back around to the, because I'm sober 17 years myself.
Well, good for you, man.
Yeah, man, I just had August 9th, 17
good
years.
Good for you, good for you.
Fucking miracle.
It, nothing but.
But, you know, the fascinating thing about your story to me is that, you know, we're in this time where, you know, people are finding new music that's really old music. I was brought up with a certain mindset about, you know, what music was. And it's at a certain point in your life, you realize that it's much broader than you ever imagined. So when Chris Campion, the man that reissued your record, South Atlantic Blues, told me about you, I was like, all right, that sounds interesting. And then, you know, I played this record and I'm like, holy shit. You know, this like this magical music from another time. And
These are nice things to be hearing, Mark. I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's fascinating to me as somebody who has struggled in show business as well for many years. How to discuss or handle the story and what you went through is... It's a hell of a tale, man, and you look pretty good.
Well, 38 years clean and sober.
That helped?
Please, I'd have been gone in 1979. I'd have been kafoodled.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about New York. So you were born in New York, but you don't have any real recollection of it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, what I was born at Bellevue Hospital, mm-hmm. appropriately.
Yeah.
my pop was a tenor man.
Oh, really? Sax?
Oh, yeah.
Like real deal, bebop guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
We lived on 52nd Street. It was 1945, 46, 47, 52nd Street, which was jazz heaven.
That's where all the musicians were and the songwriters and everything, right?
Yep. So so he came up with Prez.
No shit. Lester Young?
Yes, and Eleanora Fagan. You know who that is?
I don't know who that is. I know...
That's Billie Holiday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
So was he playing with them?
Well, he played with them.
Sure.
He was younger than them, and you know, they all had people coming up under them. So
uh-huh.
he was coming up under Lester and you know, just the influence.
Yeah.
Lester's influence on his horn playing was
Lester
fantastic.
Was like heavy influence on Art Pepper, too. Art Pepper can't shut up about Lester Young.
Well, he was great. And you know, anytime you want to hear something absolutely magical, just find some Lester Young.
So you grew up in at that time, you know, hearing your dad practice, being part of that, people over at the house.
And sitting in rehearsal halls, my sister and I, and on the little folding chairs, while they did bebop for hours and hours.
Oh,
if we weren't
God.
At the rehearsal hall, we were at the dance studio, where my mother and her twin sister were doing modern Afro-Congolese
really
outreach.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So you grew up right in the middle of Bohemian New York, in a way.
Well, we were very bored. My sister and
you couldn't appreciate it then.
God.
Look, what are they doing?
But, I mean, it was a natural for us. You know, we took very naturally to it. And then my pop couldn't resist what were called chippies.
Yeah.
Familiar Trippies. With the term?
Yeah, well, I think that evolved into groupies later.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure.
So my mother, when I asked my mother, Mud, why'd you divorce Frankie? She said, he wanted sunny side up eggs every morning.
Oh, but that was
later
it.
She confessed it was the chippies.
Yeah.
And he concurred. Anyway, we went off to the Virgin Islands with a painter.
Oh, like a, what kind? Abstract, yeah. Realist, abstract painter. Anybody of import?
Well, he eventually came back and made a good living as a commercial artist. His name was Justin Fletcher.
So he was, he married your mom?
He did not. He came back, his mother insisted he come back and marry a nice Jewish girl.
So he left you guys down
and
there.
That's what he did.
Yeah, so he took you to the Virgin Islands.
No, my mother and her twin sister took him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they'd been on their own since they were 16, and, you know, they were artsy chicks, and she had a steamer trunk full of 78s, and off we went.
And that's where you went to St. Thomas?
Yes. It's been an art colony.
Yeah, what does that
for
mean?
It means that.
Wait, what was it called? The art colony.
It was built around Claude Pissarro.
Okay.
And abstractionism.
Uh huh.
And poets, all the well-known poets in those days would come and stay at the Hotel 1829.
So this was the late 50s.
1951.
Oh,
but
really?
It had been in place for 100 years.
But that's when you got there in 51?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder, was Derek Walcott around?
Not St. Thomas.
He's
from Trinidad, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew that guy at BU. I met that
Interesting
guy.
Interesting fellow.
He is. Yeah. And a great poet, really.
Yeah. But Trinidad, you know, the archipelago stretches from Venezuela to Key West.
Yeah, I'm not good with islands. I've made some pretty embarrassing mistakes about islands.
Well, I can
get in the wrong island. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're a kid. You're at the artist colony. You got one sister?
My sister, Gail. Yeah,
uh-huh.
A year and a half older than that.
And your mom and her twin sister and this guy who doesn't hang around long.
Yeah.
And then what's life like? What's your mother doing?
She's a secretary, a legal secretary.
Yeah.
And a dancer.
Uh-huh.
Immediately we're in the art scene there.
Uh-huh.
Poets and painters and lots of gay folk. It was very attractive for gay people for many, many years also.
Oh, before they could really be out and having a life.
Well, no, everybody was out.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So it was a retreat.
Yeah.
And when did you start playing?
I started singing. My pop was a singer also, mm-hmm. a beautiful, beautiful singer.
Did you stay in touch with him all through your life or no?
No, there were long blank spaces.
Uh-huh.
My mother married 8 times.
8 times?
Yes.
I'm assuming they're not all great guys.
Well, they were all alcoholic.
Is she alcoholic?
Absolutely.
Really? Like just... Like,
born and bred. Look, man, the genetics for alcoholism go back to the first rotten mango on both sides.
You got it.
That's it.
You got the bug in your blood.
That's it.
Yeah.
So things were rough.
Right.
We were the only white children in the public school system for many, many years. And basically, she was materially challenged.
Yeah.
We were, I don't like the term poor, but we were the poorest white folks I had ever seen anywhere. And
yeah.
to this day, that's the fact.
Right.
But there was a tremendous amount of love and acceptance by local folks.
Oh, yeah?
La, that's a little white boy. Man, come, Louis, feed him something. Gail, come, no. So it was an extraordinary life. Bereft of any material comfort, but lots of hugs, lots of love, lots of acceptance.
Kind of pure.
Very much that. And then later on, I was a homeless teenager, and so I left high school in the 10th grade.
Why'd you leave home?
I didn't. Home left me.
Yeah.
And my mother was married to a local Jamaican dude who tried to murder me one night.
Oh, really?
And, you know, it is people with addiction.
Sure.
She was strung out, and he was the light in her life. And,
yeah.
And though I don't doubt she loved me very much, I'm completely confident in that. It's just the way life was in that time. Anyway, so... 2:45 in the morning, I get up and say, free as egg this, and I hitch out to the east end of the island and climb in the window of a Puerto Rican family I knew and landed in the laundry pile, and they embraced me, and I lived there with them, hablando nada más que español day and night.
Yeah.
And so we are fairly multicultural.
I would say so. And the singing publicly, when does that? So you start as a singer.
First public performance was in Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah.
The Masters Tournament.
Yeah.
So I was up in the States on the road with my pop, who had the tic-tac-toe trio.
Oh, yeah.
And they gigged all through the South. And
yeah.
One of their gigs was the Masters, some country club there. So we're in there. I'm sneaked in the joint. And
how old are you?
16.
So you got back up to the States.
Well, I came back and forth to the States. I stowed away, Mark. Two airplanes.
Can't do that anymore.
It's a little more difficult.
What do you mean you stowed away? You were in an engine or a baggage?
No. The first one was Carabair, was in St. Thomas. I jumped over the fence, got on the airplane, which was calling for Harvey McDonald to get on the plane.
Right,
so
right.
I'll be Harvey McDonald.
Yeah.
I sat down next to a beautiful little chick and said, if they ask, tell them I'm your husband. Of course, we were clearly not old enough.
Yeah.
But she said, okay, this was big adventure.
Right.
And we flew to Puerto Rico and got off the plane. And in Puerto Rico, because I'd lived in Puerto Rico now for a number of years and lived with a Puerto Rican family, so it wasn't clear whether I was Irish or Puerto Rican. And so I ran into an old borrachón, an old drinking dude, with a bottle of rum in a paper bag, who was on his way to Nueva York, and recognized a kindred spirit. So we had some rum together, and then I set out to find me next leg of the trip, which went down the stairs out to the tarmac. There was an Eastern Airlines being cleaned up and gassed up.
I
went on there and stashed myself in the bathroom, and rolling down the runway. This is flight blah blah. I think I'm going to New York or Miami. Bound for Baltimore, Philadelphia. It was November and late in November. Anyway, so I came out and sat down next to a dude who was very nervous, a gay cat who was very nervous that he'd be accused of kidnapping me. I was very pretty.
Yeah.
Very pretty kid.
Yeah.
So he was dead scared that he'd be accused of kidnapping me or yeah. molestation.
Right.
If we got to America.
Yes.
Down in Ireland, that was no concern.
Right. So he ratted you out?
No. He was just...
scared?
He was just yeah. very uptight uh-huh. the entire flight.
And you made it, though.
I did make it. So we made it to Baltimore. And I'm dressed in dungarees and a flipped-out psychedelic shirt. And I'm brown as a coconut, and I have... some no socks and some loafers or something on. Clearly not a Baltimore boy.
Yeah.
And but the police snagged me thinking that I was a runaway from a juvenile home uh-huh. in Baltimore.
Uh-huh.
I had them convinced that I was a Puerto Ricano who had gotten on the wrong plane, was supposed to be going to Miami. Y no habla inglés.
Oh, yeah.
No puedo hablar inglés. So I had him about to send me down to Miami, but uh-huh. They called me dear mother, and she loved her bonehead boy.
And he went back?
Yeah, they sent me back.
So how'd you eventually make your way to New York?
On a sailboat. I signed on as what we call a bilge rat.
And you're 16?
No, at 18, I came.
When you could legally do
50-foot sloop.
Uh-huh.
But I, you know, I'd get in trouble with the law. I was early onset alcoholism.
Yeah.
And I was a little white boy that had to create a reputation.
Right.
And defend it.
Right.
Or I'd be fish meal.
Right.
So I had a reputation. I was singing. People knew that I was a gifted singer.
And you had a band?
Not yet.
Right.
A little later,
yeah.
We were called the Urchins.
And that was in St. Thomas?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I was up in the States in Augusta, and Pop was playing the thing, and he told somebody, his son Fidel, can we speak?
Yeah.
Germanic, so
sure.
This, we call me Fidel the fucking bomb thrower from the islands.
Yeah.
Because I was an advocate for Fidel and revolution.
Oh, were you? Yeah.
Coño, puta.
Yeah, you're early radical.
Oh, yeah.
Radical commie.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, he didn't play this commie card
yeah.
until a little later.
Yeah.
He overthrew Bautista, who was a bad guy.
Yeah.
And the whole exploitive society, man, it was terrible.
Yeah.
And lots of those folks wound up in Miami and are the right wing.
Sure.
Down in Miami.
Yep.
So in the early times, young dudes were thinking, oh, yeah, this is a great change for Cuba and the
yeah.
people there. Anyway, so we're there in Augusta and...
Georgia.
Georgia.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the Masters Tournament.
Right.
And so me Pop told this guy, oh, yeah, Fidel's a great singer. He says, yeah, let me hear him sing something.
Uh-huh.
I'll give him $20 if he'll sing. So I pretended to be able to play the stand-up bass.
Yeah.
And I could fake it fairly well. And so I sang I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
Really? Yeah.
Playing the bass yeah. with the trio, and yeah. the guy gave me $20.
Uh-huh.
That was it.
Yeah, you were in.
Easiest money I ever made in my life. And the waitresses were winking.
Uh-huh.
Oh, man.
You were like, this is it. Music's the ticket.
This is it.
So you go back, you start a band?
Yeah, a trio called the Urchins.
And what kind was that? What was the music?
Well, my favorite group was the Drifters.
Oh, yeah.
Benny King.
Sure, yeah.
And there was an awful lot of calypso and Latin influence in that.
There was, yeah. Like Under the Boardwalk?
Under the Boardwalk is one of theirs, but it's at the way end, after Benny King had left.
Oh, it is. So what was Stand By Me, Benny King?
Stand By Me was Benny King,
yeah.
Spanish Harlem.
Oh, yeah.
This Magic Moment.
Oh, yeah.
Saved the Last Dance for
oh,
Me.
Oh, my God.
Young Boy Blues.
Yeah, yeah.
Fabulous stuff. On Broadway.
Oh, I'm getting choked up.
Up on the Roof.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So many.
Yeah. So the little, but in Ireland, Mark, we had one radio station.
Sure.
It had to play music for everyone. So our station played hillbilly music, Voice of America, Army brass bands.
So it was a big expat community down there?
A fairly large one, but not just American. I mean, there were Europeans.
Right.
And the VI, St. Thomas in particular, been a crossroads because of the harbor forever.
Right.
So all of that, all of those are my musical influences, and you'll hear it in the work I do, in the writing.
On South Atlantic Blues, like every the horn section. You got Calypso, and then you got the R&B horns, and then you got the sort of trippy kind of lyrical way you sing. It's all infused. Like, what's really amazing on the record is that you can hear Benny King in you.
Yeah.
Right? Those spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Benny King was just a master phraser. My pop was a master phraser, and I've tried to, you know, to make it a sort of specialty. You know?
So you're playing that kind of stuff with the urchins.
With and folk.
Right.
You know, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Sure.
As an R&B sort of...
Rocking it up a little?
Yeah, yeah. I caught the eye of a sort of wonton wench at a place called Duffy's.
Yeah.
And...
down there.
So she, we bumped lips and hips, and resulted in a child, Stephen, who I had no idea existed.
Until recently.
Stephen Merritt. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
from the magnetic field.
Yeah.
So that was a one night that you were, how old? 18?
19?
17.
Yeah, yeah.
And you, but you had.
It wasn't a one night.
No.
We were together for a few months, maybe.
Okay. Not long enough to know you had a kid coming.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
No. Anyway, so she went back to the States. The other people from the urchins went back, and I signed on as a deckhand on the Success.
To get up there, primarily.
Heading for the States, yeah.
You couldn't just go because your dad couldn't get you in? You had to, you know, you had to figure out how to work to get up there? What was the idea?
Well... I'd gone back and forth.
Yeah.
So many times. Either on his dime or my mother's dime or stowing away, like I told you. He was sort of tired of me coming and going. I mean, every time I came up, he thought, well, Fidel's going to go to school and get real. But I was real, and we were just in an entirely different reality. In the islands.
Right.
So I came up on the Success and got a gig singing in Fort Lauderdale, House of Pegasus. A small group of girls formed a Scott Fagan fan club and scribbled up $50 and bought me a bus ticket to New York.
No kidding.
God,
you had that. You were a charmer.
I was very pretty, and I sang really sweetly.
Yeah, and that'll do it.
And I liked them, and they liked me, and that was the whole story.
Yeah.
And maybe there was some jealousy in the fan club, and maybe the best thing to do is get rid of this guy.
Yeah.
send him to New York. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so they did that, and my mother... had a friend who had a friend of a friend of the ex-wife of a cousin-in-law or something, whose friend wrote songs sometimes with a guy named Doc Pompous or something.
Doc Pompous, yeah.
So, she said, take this phone number and call when you get to New York. And and I wasn't inclined to do anything that an adult suggested. But I took the number with me.
Not knowing who Doc Pomus was?
No.
Uh-huh.
Although I had a Benny King album sitting there.
Right.
I never looked at who wrote anything.
Yeah.
So I get there and I call this number.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, okay, come on over. Let me see what you got.
This is the guy, not Doc.
No, this is Doc.
Oh, you got Doc's number and you call him up. All right.
Yeah, that's the number my mother gave me was Doc Pomus. Number. Yeah.
No kidding.
Doc Pompous.
That's what it, that's what you called him?
Well, three times before I really got the correction.
Now, where was he when you went to see him?
At the Forest Hotel on 49th Street, just across the street from the Brill Building.
And he was a big presence, that guy, right?
He was a big presence.
Yeah.
See, literally, also.
Right.
He was sitting naked in the middle of a huge double bed.
Yeah.
Wrapped up in a toga. I mean, a sheet that
really?
Looked... Oh, yeah.
Smoking a cigar?
Probably.
Yeah. So he says, come on, let me see what you got.
Let me see what you got. So there's a piano bench at the end of the bed.
Yeah.
Where Mort Schumann had written all these melodies and blah, blah.
His writing partner, right.
Wurlitzer right behind him there. And
the hits. They wrote everything. This magic moment,
oh,
right?
Oh, God. They wrote Teenager in Love.
Oh, yeah.
Viva Las Vegas. Yeah. Las Vegas, Little Sister. All kinds of stuff. Anyway, let me see what you got. So I sit there. And I have my little guitar, and I sing him three songs. And at the end, he says, takes a beat. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to sign you to personal management. I'm going to sign you to the production company. Go downstairs and tell them to give you a room. Come on back here. Let's get started.
Really?
Just like that.
And you were, what, 19?
A few days into 19, yeah.
And you had no, at that moment, you still didn't know who you were reckoning with.
Well, not really.
Uh-huh.
I understood now that Doc was an important songwriter. But I had no idea of the depth of the catalog. And I didn't know anything about his partner, Mort Schumann.
Yeah.
And Mort and I became very close, and Doc and I were very close. I lived in a magical parallel universe, down in islands, on the sailboat with chicks.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Right. You were like pre-hippie, free liver.
Well, we were definitely free spirits.
Yeah.
These were maybe the earliest days of hippiedom, and
yeah.
Duffy's was hippie central,
right.
For the Caribbean.
Right.
Just a fantastic place.
So as the relationship evolves, so you get to work, you get your room, you get your management, you get to your whatever.
I thought, of course, this is the way it's supposed to happen. Of course it happened like this.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, I got a little lucky. But anyway, I had no idea what a score.
How did the relationship evolve between, you know, you and Doc and Mort? I mean, you go up there, and when did it start become apparent to you? What did you learn?
Well, he said, go get the room and come back here.
Yeah.
Let's get started.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I mean, I put my little suitcase down in there.
Yeah.
Basically sand and rocks in it. And came back. Yeah. And Doc was the central attraction in the Forest Hotel.
Uh-huh.
He sent me over to
the Brill Building.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
This is the hotel that Damon Runyon lived in.
Okay.
Also. You know Damon Runyon?
Yep. And he's right across from the Brill Building.
Let's go over there. So I went over up to the Hill and Range.
Uh-huh.
Paul Case was the professional manager there.
Uh-huh.
Go introduce yourself to Paul Case, blah, blah, let him show you around, come back over. If Doc was at a writing session, I was to participate in that. If there was a song to be demoed, I was the guy that...
Sang it.
Yeah, yeah. They wanted me to get accustomed to working in the studio right away, you know. Studios can be fairly stressful. That clock is on the wall.
Yeah.
You got an hour. You better come out of here with three tunes.
Is the studio in the Brill Building?
No, at Associated, above the Metropole. Metropole was an interesting jazz bar on 7th Avenue.
Yeah.
Upstairs was Associated Sound.
So
lots of those hits were originally done there.
Most of the Pumice and Schumann hits were done there, and what, Lieber and Stoller and stuff?
All of them, yeah.
So what was actually going on in the Brill Building when you went over there? I mean, this is, what year is this, 19...
64.
Oh, my God.
October, late September. October.
And when you went over there, did you feel the juice? I mean, was there a lot going on?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
You know, Lieber and Stoller wrote every tune that Doc and Morty didn't write.
Right. And Carol King, and Goffin and King.
That Goffin and King didn't write.
Right.
So they were all over there.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Neil and, Diamond.
Well, Neil came a little later.
Oh, okay, okay.
And it wasn't with Goffin and King. Had a different producer, okay. Another male-female songwriting mm-hmm. team. I'm not recollecting right now.
So those are the power players, certainly of the late 50s, right?
And Jerry Ragavoy.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry wrote Cry, Cry Baby.
Yeah, yeah.
Wrote Peace of My Heart.
Oh, my God.
Boy, so,
Janis Joplin just tore that one up,
oh,
huh?
Yeah, holy shit.
Yeah.
So, very quickly, I came in with the title, Cry Till My Tears Run Dry. And Doc said, okay, come on, let's write it. So Doc and Mort and I wrote this, Cry Till My Tears Run Dry. Jerry Ragavoy arranged and produced it with Irma Thomas.
And that was a you
right
were on
off the bat.
And that was a you were part of the writing crew. It was
well,
you.
Yeah, it was
and
my
Doc
title
and
my contributions. Yeah, God bless him, man. They got me right into it.
Oh,
and it's a wonderful, wonderful record. You'll hear it sometime.
Yeah,
Linda Ronstadt did it not long ago. Beautiful recording.
And this is you at what? 20 years old?
19.
19 years
yeah.
old.
Yeah, yeah.
You penned a tune with Doc Pumas and Mort Shuman.
Well, I was living in the bushes before I got on that sailboat.
I know.
This is just months ago.
Yeah, because like if you listen to the album, if you listen to South Atlantic Blues, I mean, the current of that style of songwriting alongside the Calypso stuff and some of the other beats that you pulled up, you know, from the Caribbean, I mean, there is a structure there that you must have learned from them. Because
that's what I did. I learned that structure from Doc and Mort. When you're a young songwriter... you get a little idea for a song
uh-huh.
and you try to follow it and you're following the song.
Yeah.
You're not clear about the beginning. You don't know anything about a middle.
Yeah.
And God knows where it's going to end.
Yeah.
And so they taught me very quickly.
Well, when did those songs start coming together? South Atlantic Blues? Because that's the album I
started
I know.
Writing it right there in at the Forest Hotel.
Okay.
For a song that I... worked on there was the song South Atlantic Blues.
Okay, and those were songs that you were getting feedback from Doc and working a little bit with Mort?
Mort and I wrote a tune on the album Crystal Bowl.
Okay.
The others are mine. I co-wrote a couple with a young melody man that had been sent over to work with Doc. Mort spent half of his year in England with Andrew Oldham and those folks.
And the Stones?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And all kinds of other folks. There's a whole English music business then that Mort was part of.
No kidding.
And he'd come back and so Mort and I were much closer together in age. And when the split came, Doc and his wife were having trouble, and Doc's personal life took his attention for quite a while. And and my mother was homeless in Miami. My younger brothers were in foster care, and I was there to do good work and change the world, but by God, rescue them.
Yeah.
So I couldn't friggle around.
So that was your drive. I got to make some money to save my family.
Pressure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So Mort and I were writing together and Joe Kakulis.
Yeah.
A really wonderful kid from New Haven.
Yeah.
Actually is his name was Silvio Martinez.
Uh-huh.
His mother was a Native American from Venezuela,
uh-huh.
illiterate, who'd found her way to the States and married a Greek dude
named
Kakulis.
So, I like the name Kakulis.
So they had changed Jose Silvio Martinez to Joe Kakulis.
Uh-huh.
So Joe and I were writing partners, and you know, we were up and down the street. You'd hustle a tune here, there, the next place, get a $50 advance on it.
Yeah.
Hope they did something with it, and get immediately to work writing another one. And there were seven or eight publishing companies we could hustle tunes to. And
you didn't get credit?
Oh, yeah.
No, you didn't?
No, we knew that. You do not sell your songs. You take an advance against royalties.
So you're making money doing that?
$50 a tune.
Yeah.
We're living on the floor of a publishing company on 57th Street.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed in there because clearly I'm a rascal.
Yeah.
So when Bob Hilliard company, Bob is the guy that wrote this fantastic song, Any Day Now.
Oh, yeah.
By Chuck Jackson.
Yeah.
Anyway, when Bob came, I had to hide in the closet. and at night, we'd come out and sleep. All we had to eat was a bottle of tequila.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Fortunately.
Yeah, yeah. So it was good. So we wrote a bunch of really good tunes that for South Atlantic Blues for the album.
So now once you got all the songs for the record, what was the life of the record?
Well, I was, we had all these songs.
Yeah.
And I'm living at the Earl Hotel down the village, which is where people that make very little money live.
Well, you got off the floor at the publishing house.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Moved up.
Yeah, moved up to an SRO.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And gigging at a place called the Cafe Gogo.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Anyway, there were three of us regulars at the Cafe Gogo.
Yeah.
There was Richie. There was Jimmy James and the Blue Flames. That's Jimi Hendrix. Before Chaz Chandler grabbed him.
Yeah.
So we're all working at the Cafe Gogo. You get $5 a night. One night, Howling Wolf comes through, and I told you I'm not a fanboy.
Right.
I'm just not. I mean, I'll be a fan Frankie Lyman.
Yeah.
I'll be a fan for Billie Holiday.
Got it.
But generally,
sure,
that's not my orientation.
Yeah, I relate.
So Howlin' Wolf comes through.
Yeah.
And does Smokestack Lightning.
Oh,
you know that tune?
Sure, man.
So after, I actually decide I'm going to go thank him and congratulate him.
Yeah.
So I go, Mr. Wolf, and he's a giant, you know.
Yeah.
Like 9 feet tall or something.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And he sticks his pinky out, which is the size of my wrist.
Yeah.
And that's what you're supposed to grab and uh-huh, shake, that shaking hand.
Yeah.
So I did that, and of course that cured me for being a fanboy for another 10 years.
Shaking Howlin' Wolf's pinky.
Yeah. With gratitude.
Yeah.
So we're at Cafe Gogo, and Herb Gart, a manager,
mm-hmm.
Folk rock, folk comedy, comes in, and after my set, he comes over to me, says, Scott, I've got this guy, that guy, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And if you sign with me,
yeah,
you'll be bigger than Presley in 6 months.
Yeah.
And I manage Buffy St. Marie, so bigger than Presley was interesting to me.
Yeah.
But I was a little skeptical about it. But when he said he had Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah. That was it?
Just where to sign. So.
Really?
I saw, oh, God.
You loved her.
Oh, my God. Are you familiar with
it? I'm familiar with it, but not in that way. I mean, it was before my time, and maybe I didn't know what the magic was. So I don't have an experience with it.
Well, she was a really interesting singer.
Uh-huh.
She's a person that wrote Universal Soldier and Codeine and
yeah.
a bunch of stuff. But it wasn't her singing.
Yeah.
She's a Native American, I think a Cree.
Uh-huh.
The girl is fantastic.
Yeah.
Completely magical looking.
Yeah.
The sexiest looking chick to me.
Yeah.
Oh, my, with a wonderful, shapely bottom. I mean,
So it wasn't all about the singing.
Oh, Lord. So she was a great singer, too, but yeah. I'm confessing.
Yeah, I hear you.
That it was way more primitive for me than that.
So her manager approaches you.
And says, in 6 months, I'll be bigger than Elvis Presley.
And you said, where do I sign?
And when he said, I manage Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah, right.
The idea that I might hang out in the office with her.
Yeah, that's what drove you.
Oh, yeah. I did. Drove me a lot. I have to confess, an awful lot of my work has been driven by affection for wenches,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa.
Uh-huh. Do you call them wenches to their faces?
Well, with love.
Yeah, okay.
I call them everything. They can call me anything.
Yeah. How many times have you been married?
Well, I have 5 children with 4 women.
Uh-huh.
4 different women. I've been married once.
Okay.
But this is how we do it in the islands.
Uh-huh. That is how you do it. So you signed with him?
I signed with him, and we got to work on South Atlantic Blues.
Yeah.
So Herb was the executive producer for South Atlantic Blues. He brought in Elmer Gordon to produce it. So we're in there, and Elmer has this beautiful redheaded girl that's coming to rehearsals. Yeah, I'm going down to Waverly Place, meeting Elmer. We're working out vocal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran off with Elmer's girlfriend.
Good move.
Just for the night.
Yeah.
Just for the night.
Okay.
Anyway,
that was the redhead?
Oh, God. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful New York girl.
The producer's girlfriend.
Yeah, man. Look,
Hey,
Mark.
Look, music's music, buddy.
Yeah.
I hear you.
And you're not going to say, boy, I spoke to the smartest guy in the world the other day, Scott Fagan. Anyway,
you're not alone, and I'm not sure it's dumb. It just is what it is.
Man, in those days, just the slightest hint of passion would take over.
Sure. Yeah, it's not happening anymore.
Well, it takes a little more passion for me to lose my mind now. Anyway, so I humble myself with Elmer, and Lord Almighty, we get back to a working relationship.
No shit.
Yeah. Elmer's committed to the music and committed to doing the job.
That's some dude.
Yeah, he was really something. And then another chick comes into the picture.
Now, whose wife was this?
A beautiful blonde woman from Ohio,
mm-hmm.
who was Elmer's real crush. She'd run off from her husband to come see Elmer, and we wound up together.
Elmer takes another shot.
So
what happened after that one?
Oh, God. So she decides she's going back to Ohio So I have to try and reconcile with Elmer again.
How many weeks were between these two?
Just a couple of weeks, because there was the imperative of finishing the record.
You're not making it easy.
No. Anyway, so I say to Elmer,
don't bring any more women around.
And I say, Elmer, well, what can I do to make it up to you?
Yeah.
We went to see Janis Joplin together at the Anderson Theater.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it's 1967.
Oh, wow.
So what can I do to make it up to you, Elmer? And he looks at me in this dark, scary visage.
Yeah.
I said, what can I do? He said, kill your fucking self. I said, well, I know I'm not going to do that, but I really am sorry. Anyway, so we have to give Elmer a special consideration. Thanks for overcoming his outrage and broken heart and doing such a good job with South Atlantic
Blues. He continued on.
He did.
Is he still around?
No.
Uh-huh.
No, and, you know, we became great friends, and... we were great friends. I guess he knew. Look, I can't explain it other than realistically. I would follow a chick anywhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
Period.
Yeah, it happens.
So
you finished the record.
We finished the record.
Beautiful record. And you both know it's special.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Most folks around are thinking this is it. Really good. So Apple Records is holding it. So they're trying to decide between South Atlantic Blues and James Taylor's right. First album.
Yep.
And it's going on and on and on and on. And there's another very hot label at the time, Verve Forecast.
Uh-huh.
Which is the folk rock label.
Yeah.
And Jerry Ooh. Schoenbaum is the president of that label.
Who's on that label?
All of them.
Uh-huh.
All of them. Tim Harden.
Oh.
All of them. The Blues Project. Everybody.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
So Jerry Schoenbaum is the head of the label. He says, I want the record. I'm going to be the new president at ATCO. And I want to take the record with me. It'll be my first release at ATCO.
They did the Stones records?
And the Drifters were on ATCO, Benny King. So
your guys.
I'll
yeah.
sign with them.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Fuck Apple.
We've got to move, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And God bless the Beatles, but brother, I'm not a fanboy. And yeah. I'm not... that impressed.
No pinky shaking with John Paul, George, and Ringo.
Well, we'll shake hands. I'm not sure. shaking pinkies yeah. with them.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not waiting. I mean, I yeah. can't wait. My brothers are in foster care.
Yeah.
My mother's a homeless woman in Key West or, yeah. or Dinner Key or right. wherever.
Yeah.
So we signed with ATCO. And it's a thrill. I mean, this is really going to be something. And he loves the record, and bang, Jerry never comes to term on his own contract.
After you signed.
With ATCO. So, boof, he's gone off to California to land where I don't know.
Did he apologize?
Well, I've never seen him again.
No
I
shit.
Mean, he probably felt bad about it. So Jerry's gone, so our album is now stuck with ATCO.
Mm-hmm. And no support.
Well, no. I mean, the last thing anyone's going to do is promote the other guys.
The guy that wasn't ever there.
Yeah, yeah. And plus they have their own favorite
right.
projects. So.
You get lost in the mix.
So, well, it was released, but... There was no promotion, blah,
oh,
blah, blah.
God.
Anyway.
So where were,
that
how did
happens.
You feel?
I
yeah,
mean,
no,
that
sure.
happens.
I've heard it. I've
yeah.
heard it. Yeah.
yeah. So I felt, of course, deeply upset about it. You think, gee, am I ever going to be able to write this many good songs again?
Yeah.
Am I ever going to get another deal? And I can't re-record any of these songs. For 7 years and blah, blah, blah. And our advance against royalties stopped and blah, blah. So
no money, no tour, no
movement.
And
a baby.
And a baby and no movement on record. Two siblings in foster care. Mother is homeless
yeah,
and
yeah,
a baby.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So fortunately, we'd interested Bill Krasilowski, who was the lawyer that wrote This Business of Music 1 and 2 and 3. A great, great lawyer.
Yeah.
Aretha's lawyer also.
Yeah.
And he got a deal for us at Tommy Volando Music. Tommy Volando was a big musical show publisher.
Uh-huh.
So we're signed as writers there, Joe and I.
Musicals.
Well, we're going to write songs. Within the first week or so, the professional managers, that's Jay Morgenstern and Frank Military,
yeah,
want to hear our material,
yeah,
get familiar with it. So I'm there with the guitar singing. Joe, I've just written this song called Hideaway.
Yeah.
A really nice, powerful tune.
Not the instrumental.
No.
Right.
So Joe says to them, I want you to hear this. We're working on a rock opera.
Yeah.
played a song for him. So Joe convinces him that this song, Hideaway, is piece of a rock opera that we're writing.
He's got a good hustle, that dude.
Yeah, he was a beauty. So, they hear Hideaway, and it's terrific, and, they have the hot new team here. All the rest of the guys were much older and established.
You getting paid?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So the kid's eating? You getting money to your siblings?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
When I got the advance for signing with Atco, I bought them each a bike. My sweetie and I went home. I took my sister back.
Yeah.
And we made a triumphant tour of the bars in Charlotte Amalia.
Yeah.
And bought the boys a bicycle each and really.
What about your mother?
Mud's somewhere.
Yeah,
don't know where.
Okay.
Somewhere.
Yeah. So you're writing a rock opera.
Well, so now we're writing a rock opera.
And there's never been a rock opera at this point.
There's been no rock opera. There's been no thought about writing a rock opera. I've never even seen a musical except I saw West Side Story in the theater.
Right. No Godspell, no Jesus Christ Superstar, no Tommy.
No.
Yeah, nothing.
So we're discussing what we're going to write and blah, blah. This is anti-war time.
Yeah.
We are out on the street protesting, my partner and I, trying to make change in the world. So what we decide we're going to do is tell the story of the music business, what it's really like, what it really does to artists, the impact it has on the society.
Yeah.
What kind of characters are shaping everyone's destiny.
And you've got a lot of fresh bile.
Yeah, we're going to write this and it's going to be the follow-up to South Atlantic Blues.
Yeah.
And it's going to change the music business.
Yeah, you got a little bit of fuck you in you?
A whole lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
A whole lot of that soon also.
Yeah.
Really. Anyway, so we write this fabulous piece of work. This is not an entertainment.
Yeah.
This is an expose of the dishonesty and the ridiculous characters that run the ship.
Yeah.
So we have pretty much the score, and Vicky Sue Robinson and I are doing the vocals, singing the tunes.
Yeah.
Vicky is our dear, dear friend. And so we interest Edgar Bronfman, the owner of Seagram's.
Yeah.
And so we've got them on board and blah, blah, blah. And before we know it, we're in the Anderson Theater where we'd seen
Janis Joplin. Yeah.
Doing rehearsals. And we're on our way to the Ritz Theater on 48th between Broadway and 8th Avenue.
Uh-huh.
And this piece is going to change the music business. And it's going to be the follow-up to South Atlantic Blues.
Yeah.
And if they didn't get South Atlantic Blues, they're going to get this.
Yeah.
And so the producers want certain changes so they can pre-sell tickets to the ladies that come in on Wednesdays and Tuesdays and
Sundays,
matinees.
Yeah.
The nice ladies with blue hair. The
theater ladies.
Yes. And that's a fine thing, Mark.
Yeah, I know.
But
I
it wasn't fine in that time, in that moment.
No, you guys had something to
no,
say.
No. We're serious dudes.
Yeah.
And so we wouldn't make the changes they want.
Sure. Good for you.
So so I was doing the lead, and so we were fired.
Yeah.
And barred from the theater.
Uh-huh.
The director, who was our co-writer, Robert Greenwald, who has gone on to do wonderful things with Brave New Films. He's the one that's doing, he's the guy that did Burning Bed and The Love Canal and all this stuff. And so we're barred from the theater. They bring some, they bring Gerald Friedman in, who was an early director here, to make it an entertainment. And they fire me and bring Barry Bostwick in, who's a theater guy.
Yeah, sure.
And
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
And so they go back into rehearsal, and the score, it really, really is very good. We had the best cast imaginable. My understudy was Richard Gere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Peter Allen played the manager.
No kidding.
Yeah. Vicky Sue Robinson, Nell Carter. These are great, great,
great
vocalists.
So you couldn't go in the theater, but you still wrote the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert is flaming angry.
Yeah.
Robert's father is a psychiatrist. His mother is a psychologist.
Uh-huh.
Robert is livid. So Kukulis and I are trying to talk our friend down a little bit. Come on, Ed, man, we'll figure it out. Peace and love and blah, blah, blah. Robert says, fuck that shit. I'm getting even. So we said, well, you can't be angry like they said. Fuck that shit. I'm using my anger. His father, the psychiatrist, had told him, oh, you got to direct that anger. That anger will really move you along.
Yeah.
His mother concurred with that. So Robert used that, directed, subliminated that anger towards becoming successful. He said, oh, fuck him. I'm going to get even. I'm going to get successful. Robert won a Tony with Ain't Misbehavin' years later. Yeah, yeah, with Nell Carter.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so he wound up at the Center Theater Group here, and Gordon Davidson was in New York, and I was invited up to his hotel room to sing the score for him.
Which what was the name of the show?
Soon.
Yeah.
So we came out here and did it at the Pilgrimage Theater there.
72.
Yeah.
Yeah. How'd it go over?
Oh, really well.
Oh, good.
But we didn't get it recorded. Joe and I were immediately fired from our writing gig.
Right.
And dropped from my deal with Epic.
That was after ATCO?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And no recording exists of it?
Well, we did a little live recording on a Roland sack and a cassette, a very rough thing, which I tried to clean up.
Yeah.
Not long ago in New York, we were in the studio a long time trying to get it cleaned up. And I get a call one day or an email from, there's a parallel universe of Broadway collectors.
Yeah.
That's all that exists in that universe is people that collect Broadway stuff.
Yeah.
So one of them called me and says, don't you have any recordings of Soon? Can I have what do you got? Blah. I said, no, there's no recording. He said, oh, yeah, well, a guy just donated his collection to the Library of Congress, and there's a recording of Soon in there. It turned out that a dude had stuffed a cassette in his inside overcoat pocket and it recorded it in the theater there, and it's full of snuffles and burps and stuff. It's there, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want that to be my legacy in the Library of Congress because our piece is sung through. There's no dialogue.
Right.
And they brought this dude in, and he stuck in all this square dialogue and blah, 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 and stuff that is to be amusing to the Tuesday afternoon ladies.
Sure.
Which is another reason I absolutely have to get Soon recorded something, and I will. Anyway, so I wrote called the Library of Congress, and they sent it on to me, and I have it there next to the California recording.
Uh-huh.
And I think that Chris Campion
is going to put it out.
I think that we're going to get it re-released.
So you do the Soon, and that doesn't go. So,
well, not only did it not go, it sunk my career.
Yeah.
We were fired and barred and bang. So we were back to hustling tunes. And after the experience of Soon, Kukulis never wrote another song.
And what did you do?
Well, I hustled songs and I sang and Mark, fuck them. They're not going to turn me around. They're yeah. not going to turn me around. So I've been at it all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
Out there singing.
Singing, writing, some of every scriffle in the world. I have five children. I had to take care of them. There's nothing I haven't done except sell weed and
yeah.
dope. I just
yeah.
don't do that. But some of everything.
Huh. What was your moment of clarity?
You know, I am a child and grandchild of alcoholics.
Yeah.
So I, through my life and these eight marriages and my mother's, swore I would never be like that.
Yeah.
I will never be like that.
Right.
I won't be like them. And when I discovered, look, I had juice next to the bed. I couldn't wake up in the morning without juice. Are there cigarette butts in there? Too bad for them.
Yeah.
Are there cockroaches? Too bad for them.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother died, and I couldn't get sober. I mean, I could not.
After you moved her to
myself.
New York.
Yeah. I was in the islands doing a gig.
Yeah.
We came back the second day we were back. Annie comes running up. I have my twins, Lily and Archie, their mother's name is Annie.
Yeah.
Comes running up and said, something happened to Mud. So we go down there and she has gone kaput. And so I love my mother as much or more as anyone else. But I, you know, I've been on a long gig in the islands and drinking hard. And when she died, I just somehow, you know, our tolerance grows
yeah.
through the years and then suddenly it collapses. And there you're left strung out, you're left addicted with no ability to tolerate or process it.
Yeah.
So that was a state. Of course, I didn't know that then.
Right.
That was a state. I had lost my tolerance, but I was addicted to the substance. And I couldn't get sober. I mean, I couldn't write a song. I couldn't concentrate enough to write. People were wanting me to do work. Come on, Scott, do a vocal here for us, blah, 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 blah. And I realized that I'd become that which I despised most. And I'm standing in the window. We had this beautiful old brownstone one, windows around the corners. I'm standing with my twins in my arms. They're a year and a half old or something. And I'm thinking I should jump out the window. And I got so disgusted with myself. For my grandfather, by the way, had stopped his car in front of a train and committed suicide when my mother and her twin were 9 years old, and they'd never gotten over it. So I'm thinking this, and I'm saying I'm completely disgusted with my cowardice. I'm thinking to kill myself, and affect all these children forever. Rather than confessing that I'd become strung out on the juice and had to let it go. So I decided that whether I never laughed again, whether I never sang again, I was going to be more for these children than my people had been for me.
And you did it.
And, by, well, it's a miracle.
And when did you find out about Stephen... Merritt.
So I...
Magnetic fields.
I'm in Oxford, Mississippi.
What are you doing there?
The mother of my youngest.
Yeah.
My youngest little girl.
Yeah.
Holiday. And I, she's going to Ole Miss.
Yeah.
So my ex-wife Annie calls.
I just heard there's a kid on the radio saying you're his father. What's going on?
So, apparently Stephen was on Fresh Air.
Yeah, with Terry, yeah. Terry Gross, yeah.
And had announced that his father was Scott Fagan.
He never reached out to you?
No.
He just heard it.
I think that was his reach out.
That was it?
Yeah. So, a friend of Annie's had heard this and called Annie, and Annie went ballistic, even though she's my ex-wife and I'm with a new woman and a new child.
Yeah.
Look, people love each other.
Sure.
And express it in the strangest ways.
Uh-huh.
And I have no animosity towards any of them.
Yeah.
The fact is, I failed every one of them.
Yeah.
That every one of them thought I was the man who was going to change their lives. Clearly, he's going to be successful.
Uh-huh.
And I disappointed every one of them. So, and I wish to God that I hadn't disappointed them. And I hope to God that I can do something to change everyone's life going forward. Anyway,
who's this kid that's saying you're his father?
So I called, I tracked down, and they put me in touch with a booking agency in Chicago, Red Rider or something.
Uh-huh.
And they put me in touch with Claudia Gonson, who's Steven's manager,
uh-huh,
and the drummer in the band. Great, great woman. And so we began email correspondence.
You and Steven.
Yeah.
And he's a great musician.
He's terrific.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, the music doesn't start with me.
Right.
My pop was a great singer.
Right.
And a great tenor man.
But you didn't know this son of yours, and so you're emailing, and what's that? How's it unfold?
I'll tell you in a moment. So, but my father's mother was an orphan girl from Scotland who was a barroom singer. Her people had died in the Spanish flu.
Mm-hmm.
So the music goes back on that side and the other side. So there's this kid. So we start this correspondence, and they're just releasing this album, 69 Love Songs.
Yeah.
So we're in Oxford, Mississippi, which is an interesting place.
Yeah.
You've been there?
Yeah, it's where Faulkner's from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting place. And they have the greatest little bookstore in the South is right there on the square.
Yeah.
And they have a little ice cream parlor upstairs. It's really a little dish of ice cream.
Yeah.
I take my little girl a holiday there, and we'd sit there and the books and
eat the ice cream.
Wonderful. Yeah. Anyway, so I went to a little record store there and bought this album, 69 Love Songs.
Yeah.
And I put it on, and it was the strangest feeling. Every one of those tunes, every one of the songs, seemed to me like something I'd started and hadn't finished.
Yeah.
Why? I wouldn't turn it that way. I would have taken it this way. And there's this kid singing in my baritone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't freaking believe it. I couldn't believe it. And here's 69 songs, for God's sake.
And did you like the record?
Well, I did, because he's a great writer.
Yeah.
And I like that vocal, too.
Sure. And do you have a relationship with him now?
Yeah, yeah. So, a year or two later, we got his mother involved in the relationship also.
That was that woman in the islands, right?
Yes, yeah.
That you had the fling with.
Yeah, yeah.
For 4 months.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So he was actually planted on a houseboat in St. Thomas. Anyway, so they were doing a movie about Doc Pomus.
Yeah.
And I was invited to be part of that, and so I went to New York did some interviews and did maybe some 10 minutes in the film or something. And so they're going to do the premiere at Lincoln Center.
Yeah.
So I said, well, this might be an interesting time for them because the mom knows Doc Promise. And I hear the same structure you were talking about in my songs, in his songs.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear an influence of that. Whether it's real or not, I hear that.
Yeah.
And so I invite them to come to the premiere. And by God, sitting there and up comes this perfectly straight-looking woman in her late 60s. Who the hell is this?
Yeah.
This is, I used to call her Lotus Blossom down in the islands.
Yeah.
She is actually an English teacher, and her name is Alex now. And then here comes a kid that looks surprisingly like me.
Sure. Not so surprisingly, area. Yeah.
With a bodyguard. He's brought a bodyguard along. He's very funny. I mean, he says, look, he was avoiding me because God knows when I might need a kidney or something.
Right.
Anyway, so we met and had a great time.
That's sweet.
And then we met again when it opened in a movie down in a theater down in East Village.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of email. And we met again at a couple more times. And I've spent a fair amount of time with Alex. And we email back odd comments.
Huh, that's great.
Yeah. We'll do some work someday.
Well, that's a great story, man. And you survived and you're sober and you're doing good things for other sober people and you're still making music and this record is rediscovered.
It's fantastic. And I think that most of my success can be traced to the fact that my mother made me promise to always be nice.
How's your voice? Good? Holding up?
Yeah, surprisingly well. I mean, I've been singing. I vocalize all the time.
Great.
I've been singing all through these years.
Great.
And I'm really happy to say it's really. I mean, this little gruff stuff I'm doing with you, I shouldn't ever do.
No. I was curious.
It messes with the pipes, but yeah. Thank goodness, Mark.
Singing
is good.
I'll tell you, Scott, it's a hell of a story, and I'm sure there's a lot more, and I'm just happy that, you know, this turn happened, because, you know, you definitely paid your dues, man.
Well, you know, all I did was do my best and be nice. And by God, if I knew that was the key to success, I'd have done that long ago.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'd go get that record. It's beautiful, and you can do that today. Yeah, it's nice, and it'll take you someplace, and it'll be sweet on Thanksgiving. So again, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Go to WTFPodTour.com. I've got upcoming dates in the spring, but December 3rd in Chicago. Also, come back tomorrow and check your podcast feed for something new. We got some surprises every Friday for the rest of the year. So check it out. I think you're going to like it. We're going to go into the vault that I didn't even know existed. I'm going to play a little guitar because it'll be nice. Should I make it nice? Or should I lean in? We'll be right back. screwed up a little. Happy Thanksgiving. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.